Every once in a while, you're pulled up short by a news story of a personal disaster that just strikes a family out of a clear blue sky. Everything was fine, and 10 minutes later, someone's gone, and they're never coming back. One day in 2014, Decca Aitkenhead was that person. The family disaster in the news was her family disaster. Decca, her partner Tony, and their two little boys were on vacation in Jamaica when Tony was killed through a freakish set of circumstances. Afterwards, Decca and her little boy Jake blamed themselves for what had happened, even though they were in no way at fault. Everything had been fine, better than fine that morning, until it wasn't. Decca Aitkenhead's memoir is called All at Sea, and she's in Australia as a guest of Adelaide Writers Week. Hi, Decca.
Hi, Richard.
You've been going to Treasure Beach in Jamaica for many years. What kept you coming back?
I first discovered it just quite by accident. I was sent there to write a travel piece for the newspaper that I was working for, and it's difficult to explain really how it gets under your skin. It's a very modest, ramshackle little dusty fishing village. It's not a fancy resort. It's not full of kind of glamorous celebrities. St. Bart's it is not. It's a very simple, rather timeless, very sort of sweet, gentle little village. And like most visitors probably, I made the classic mistake when I first went there thinking, oh God, this is so lovely. Nothing happens here. And in fact, because of that, when I was writing another book a few years after I first visited there, I thought, where could I go where the days will just yawn ahead of me in this open canvas and I'll get lots of work done? I thought, I know Treasure Beach in Jamaica. Perfect. And I couldn't have been more wrong, of course, because like most places that look superficially sleepy, underneath this rather beguilingly calm surface, there was more sort of intrigue and drama and comedy and adventure than, to be honest, I've ever actually found in London.
So it sounds like you formed relationships and friendships there.
Some of my oldest friendships are there. And needless to say, actually, I completely failed to get the book written there because what was going on in Treasure Beach was infinitely more interesting than anything that I could commit to print. And so you had this sense when you would land and you'd drive for hours across the mountains, across Jamaica, and you'd finally reach there and you felt as if you'd... It was almost as if you'd fallen off the end of the universe and nothing much changed there. And so you could always, if you'd been away for sometimes as much as a year, you know, from the moment you got there, it was as if you were just re-enveloped into this community and all of its melodramas and its intrigues. So it was a really, really very important part of our life. And my partner, Tony, had never been to Jamaica when I first took him there. And he too absolutely fell in love with it. And our eldest son was named after the one hotel in the village. And so it was just a really big, precious part of our lives.
So what was going on in your lives that made you think you needed to go on a holiday at this time in 2014?
Ah, so having always, as an adult, lived in London, we'd reached that classic kind of middle-age stage where you feel as if your life is really settled. We had two small children. And London holds very little for a 3- and 4-year-old. And actually, it doesn't really hold much for parents who are exhausted and who are working too hard. So we had the classic kind of rural fantasy that we would go and find, and indeed we did, a beautiful old 16th century falling down cottage surrounded by sort of tumbling down barns and bluebells. And it was just magical. So a year, almost to the day before this terrible accident, we left London and set off with wildly naive excitement about what it would be like to renovate a medieval cottage with two small children.
The reality of that is just nightmarishly stressful, isn't it?
Oh, it's just awful.
So that bucolic image you have in your mind.
Six months in, I mean, we'd had no heating, we had no walls for quite a period of time. At one point, we had to just keep a fire going the whole time, and so we just burnt bits of the house as the builders dispensed them. The dining room floor burnt really well. And it was kind of like indoor camping, and it was charming and fun and exciting at first, but my God, by the sort of depths of winter, by February, March time, we were the walking wounded and we'd really had enough. And I can remember so clearly, it was a particularly cold, miserable night, and we're huddled around this fireplace where we're burning bits of our house. And of course, you know, we'd done that classic thing of gone over budget and spent too much money. So we were going to have to borrow a bundle more money. And in that slightly mad way that you do when you start to get into debt, I thought, well, you know what? What's a couple of grand more is not really going to make any difference in the greater scheme of things. I'm not sure we're actually going to survive this winter unless we go away. So I said to Tony, why don't we just escape to Treasure Beach for a couple of weeks, escape from the builders, escape from the hellhole of kind of dust and rubble. And we'll come home whole and ready to see out the rest of this renovation project. That was the thinking behind the holiday. And it all, of course, seemed to make perfect sense.
So the holiday was lovely.
Oh, it was gorgeous. The first 11 days of it were just magical. We stayed in a little cottage on a beach called Calabash Beach. It's just a tiny little kind of curl of sand. There's only about half a dozen cottages on the beach. There's fishing boats at one end, and, you know, I'm good friends with most of the fishermen. We've known each other years. So it was a very peaceful, wholesome kind of holiday, as it always is with a couple of small kids. You know, we would be up at dawn and down rock pooling. And in fact, I have this very clear memory on day 10 of lying back on the beach with Tony, and we were watching our two boys play in the sand. He said, "Do you think our grandchildren are going to come here on holiday?" And it was such an extraordinary idea. You know, it felt to picture one's grandchildren, you have to have a certain sense that your life is settled. And I remember leaning back and thinking, wow, Tony, that's an amazing idea. Yeah, I really hope they do. And that was on the afternoon of day 10 of the holiday.
Part of the attraction was the beach there. What are the conditions in that beach normally like?
There are two beaches in Treasure Beach. One's called Frenchman's, and the waves can be quite big there, quite rough, and the kids would love it, you know, because it was sort of exciting and dramatic. But the beach we were staying on, I mean, it was literally like a mill pond the entire time we were there. The kids would marvel at how they could see their toenails while they were swimming, and it was more like a lake, really. It would be impossible to imagine a more benign, placid, gentle little spot.
So what happened on that morning? What do you remember how that morning started for you, Decca?
We woke around 7 and Tony made some coffee, and a friend of ours from the village was passing by the cottage. A very good friend of Tony's, a guy called Shugu. And Tony said, "Oh, Shug, you know, come down to the beach and have a coffee." So he made an extra cup and they wandered down the path, which is only about 20 feet to the beach, just down a little grassy bank. And Jake went with them. Jake was still in his pyjamas.
This is your oldest boy.
Our oldest boy, who was 4 at the time, couldn't swim. And so if he was going to go into the ocean, you know, he would wear one of those flotation vests. But there was no intention of doing anything like that. We'd only just woken up. And I watched Tony and Shugu wander down to the beach and Jake with them. And I stayed on the deck of the cottage. My younger son was inside playing in the bedroom. And I had all these fancy notions that I was going to take up yoga, which people always tell you should do, don't they? And I'd been putting it off for years, and I thought, right, okay, maybe the time has come. And so I was just doing some stretches on the deck of the cottage. And as I eased out of a stretch and looked up, I thought, God, that's funny. Somebody's swimming. I thought the beach was deserted. And I looked again, and I thought, I think that's a child's head. And it was only a few feet offshore, where normally you could walk 30 or 40 feet into that ocean and you'd only be waist deep. So I was slightly puzzled. And I remember kind of turning left and right and scanning the beach, thinking, I wonder where its parents are. And then suddenly my head snapped back. I thought, that couldn't be Jake in the water, could it? And in my mind, I think, of course not. You know, I mean, he can't swim. He's in his pyjamas. Tony was never really very keen on swimming. You know, I was the one who was always charging into the sea with the kids. And I looked again and thought, oh, well, it can't be. And then, it must be Jake. Oh, that's so strange. Tony wouldn't let him into the water by himself. And, he must have put his swimming vest on. I must have missed it. And there was what's called calabash tree, whose branches kind of overhung the deck of the cottage. And I never forget just kind of scanning idly and looking up and seeing Jake's brother Joe's vest hanging in the tree where we'd left it to dry the night before. And then my eyes kind of move along an inch and there's Jake's flotation vest hanging to dry in the tree. And in that moment, your mind just absolutely floods with panic. You think, my God, that is my 4-year-old son, and he's in the ocean, and he can't swim, and he's clearly out of his depth. And I just flew down the path. And it was only a matter of seconds before I'd even got through the gate and onto the sand. Tony was already off the deck, off his sun lounger, and into the water, and he had Jake in his hands, and he's holding Jake aloft, and Jake's kind of spluttering. And I remember flopping onto the beach, thinking, oh, thank God for that. It was such a momentary, tiny, inconsequential thing. Had that been what happened, had Tony just carried him out of the water, it wouldn't have merited mentioning to somebody over lunch, you know. It was that innocuous. And I sat on the sand waiting for Tony to bring him back and suddenly realised something was wrong because they weren't coming back to shore. They were, in fact, they seemed to be drifting out to sea. And I suddenly realised Tony shouting, help! And you don't stop to think, you know, I just sprung to my feet and plunged into the water. And I remember even at that moment thinking, well, this looks a bit melodramatic. I've still got my gym kit on. It's a bit sort of ridiculous to be running into the water with your clothes on. But obviously I didn't stop and I swam to them and I was with them in what felt like moments. And Tony and I didn't even exchange a word. We were just both very focused on our son, and he handed Jake to me. And as luck would have it, you know, when I was a child, I was taught how to do life-saving. It's pretty straightforward. There's nothing much to it. You know, you lie on your back, you lie the person on their back, and you cup your hand around their chin, and then you've got one arm free to swim. And I put Jake on his back, and we started to swim for shore. And, of course, you know, you're lying on your back, and you're gazing up at the blue sky, and your ears are submerged under the water. So you're kind of cocooned from what's going on. I was just concentrating on swimming. But I had a sense that we didn't seem to be moving, which felt odd. You know, it felt as if we should be back on the beach within seconds. And after a while, I turned to look at the beach and got the fright of my life, because instead of it being a few feet away, it seemed a really long way away.
This is what Australians know as a rip.
That's exactly.
Undertow.
Australians will be some people call it a rip, some people call it undertow. I'm not even sure if they're...
Same thing.
That's what I thought. But I knew Treasure Beach well enough to have been caught in riptides before, you know, and I knew what they were like. And I remember thinking, crap, this is one hell of a riptide. I've not been in one like this before.
You can swim and swim and swim and find you're further out.
It's like trying to walk up an escalator that's going down, you know. That was the first sort of moment where I felt a slight judder, thinking, whoa, this isn't quite as straightforward as I thought it was. You know, this is going to be quite a tough swim. But it was still only that. It was just going to be a tough, you know, it's going to take a bit longer and be a bit harder than I thought it would. And Jake was fine. At one point he wriggled and he came and turned to face me, said, I want to face you. And of course at that moment we just immediately began to kind of sink, and I remember shouting at Jake, no. And I think he was slightly alarmed by the panic in my voice. But you know, once we were both back on our back, it just felt like a bit of a tough swim, that's all. But it went on and on. And eventually I became aware that there was a head in the water a few feet away from us. And I turned and I could see it was a fisherman that we know called Blauser. Blauser's kind of man, more fish than man, really. He half lives in the ocean. And I was really shocked to see he looked frightened and kind of and drained. And I could see he was just tipping his head back to try and stay above water.
Decker, had he come into the water to help you?
I think he'd come into the water to try and swim to Tony. And he had exhausted himself trying to do that. What I wasn't aware by that point was that two other fishermen who were already in the water and were much closer to Tony. So I think at that point, Blauser had come to us. And I shouted, Blauser, can you take my hand? And he kind of reached across, and we were only probably a yard from being in our depths at that point. And I saw Blauser in his depth, and I'm sort of searching with my toes for that wet sand. You know, that lovely feeling of relief when you feel the sand. And it's all over then, isn't it? You know, and I'm slightly puzzled about why Blauser looked so shattered and so sort of frightened. That seemed a bit of a puzzle. But I hoisted Jake onto my hip and we waded ashore. And I plonked Jake down in the sand and said, oh, my God, sweetheart, you OK? And he says, yes. And he's kind of untroubled. He seems to think it's been a bit of an adventure. And it had that kind of quality to it, nothing more than that. And I turned back to the sea, expecting that Tony would be a few yards behind us. I thought I was going to turn and see Tony wading out of the ocean. And that's just really kind of when time stopped, because I turned and he's nowhere near us. He's actually, by this point, he's 40 or 50 feet out in the waves and he's just floundering, and I can hear him calling help. And he's clearly in real, real trouble. And at that moment, I just dashed to go back into the sea. And Blauser shouted, no, stop. And I realised then that there are these two other fishermen who are going to get to him much more quickly than I will. And even at that point, Richard, sometimes I find this embarrassing to admit, but I became aware then that out of the other cottages on the beach, people are streaming. I can see a tourist and she's got a boogie board and she's streaming out of her house further up the beach. And a friend of ours who worked in the villa next door came barreling down the bank looking absolutely fraught. And he's got a life ring in his arms. And in that moment, even at that point, what I honestly thought to myself was, oh, God, this is embarrassing. We're making a bit of a spectacle. It felt a bit over the top what was happening, this kind of sense of drama. I don't know if that tells us something about what one's brain is willing to take on board. And certainly what happened in the course of the next 15 minutes has really opened my eyes to one's capacity in the moment for blind denial. Because in that moment, even though Tony is 40 feet out there and people are panicking, I'm thinking, oh God, we look a bit idiotic, don't we? We've caused a fuss. But then the fishermen just seemed unable to get to Tony, and suddenly, you know, I'm pacing on the beach and I hear these words come out of my mouth, and they frighten me so much I scream at them, get to him, he's drowning. And I was so taken aback I thought, what? It was almost as if somebody else had said, that can't be what's happening. This is ridiculous. We're on Treasure Beach. We were having coffee 5 minutes ago. This is insane. This isn't happening. And eventually, the fishermen got to Tony and they had a life ring in their arms. And we had the end of the rope, myself and a friend who worked in the guest house next door, Michael. And we just stood sort of ankle deep in the surf and we're pulling them in, a bit like a kind of tug of war team. And at that moment, all you're feeling is relief because it's over. Everything's over. It's fine. He hasn't gone under. You know, these fishermen are my friends and they've got him in his arms and they've got this rubber ring. And eventually we pulled them in and Tony kind of flopped on his back onto the sand, onto the wet sand next to us. And it's only at that moment that I realised that Jake, our son, has been sitting on the other side of me all this time. And I looked down and said, oh, Jake, are you okay? And he looked up at me and he said, no, I'm not. I'm really worried about him. What's that white stuff coming out of his nose? And I couldn't think what he meant. And I turned to look at Tony. I'm expecting Tony to kind of be, you know, pulling sand out of his ears and shaking his dreadlocks. And instead he's lying there with his eyes closed. And there's just these two trickles of kind of white foam coming out of his nostrils. And if I'm really honest with him, I must in that moment have grasped the significance of what was happening. But something else kind of took over in my mind. I thought, oh, he needs to do that thing they used to do on Baywatch when you'd have your stomach kind of pummeled and then you vomit up a great big bucket load of water and then you're okay. And I thought, well, that's not going to be very nice for Jake to see. At least this is what my conscious mind was thinking. And so I said to Jake, oh, he'll be fine. They just need to make him be sick. Let's walk back to the cottage. And it was this absolute kind of surreal walk. We take a few steps and we're back up on our cottage deck. And Jake's brother, Joe, who was three then, has at some point wondered where everyone's gone and come out and he's straining, trying to see the commotion. And they say, is Tony okay? And I hear myself again in this kind of very light, sort of rather brittle way. Oh, yeah, they're sending a doctor, it's fine. But obviously I know it isn't fine at that point. But I'm trying to kind of keep calm in front of the kids. And I remember thinking, I need to go and ring the hotel around the headland, just a little hotel. And I'm in such a blind panic, I realise I'm trying to make a phone call with my iPod. And eventually I kind of find my phone and I'm stabbing the number and I'm screaming down the phone to them, send help, this is really serious. Tony's being pulled from the water, he's unconscious. And suddenly to them, I can hear the hysteria in my voice. And I still don't even know, am I making a silly fuss over nothing? And I'm worried that the kids are going to be a bit alarmed. But also at that point, I'm worried about whether they're going to send help in time. And the boys say, we want to go down and see him. You know, half an hour ago, the beach had been literally deserted. Apart from Jake and Shugu and Tony, there had been no one on it. And now it looked like some kind of huge beach carnival. There are people streaming from all directions and they're screaming and shouting. And I see a jeep pulling up further up the beach and my friend Annabelle comes flying out of it. And she's racing across the sand because her sister lived on Calabash Beach and her sister had seen someone in trouble in the water and had immediately phoned her because Annabelle has medical training in CPR. And Annabelle had no idea who it was. You know, Annabelle assumed that she was just coming to sort of rescue some random tourist. And it wasn't until she kind of felt her knees over him, ready to resuscitate him, she looks up and says, oh my God, it's Tony. And at this point, I take the boys and we stand behind her at the water's edge and so we can see her back. What I see is I see Annabelle take her forefingers, and she rests them against his neck for his pulse. And I remember in that moment thinking, what? That's insane. Why does she need to do that? This is a... And then her fingers stay there and everybody kind of freezes and we watch the back of her head as she looks up and she looks at the semicircle of men standing over Tony and I just watch the back of her head shake very slowly. And of course, I understand the significance of that. And my sons, I have a son in either hand, they have no idea. They don't know what it looks like when somebody checks for a pulse. And again, in this kind of blind state of denial, I decide that I don't, it's not that I don't know, I just decide I don't believe it. Tony's going to be fine. This is, and yet as I'm thinking that, I'm very quietly drawing the children away and I say, let's go back up to the cottage. And it's the most sort of surreal sense that there is now this colossal commotion. I mean, it looks like a scene from a disaster movie. It's absolute pandemonium. And at the heart of it is my husband and the boys' children. And I just, it's so strange. I just kind of thought, I just led them away from it. As if somehow if we went away, something else, when we came back, something different would be happening. It is strange. I always thought that I had a very kind of rational, logical mind. But in these moments, your mind takes on a whole different life of its own. And we walked back up to the cottage. And I hear myself say, oh, let's wash the sand off you. And I think, when I think about it now, I think I just had some kind of bizarre notion that if we went and did something really simple and normal, like we're just going to go to the bathroom and wash the sand off him, that's a really normal thing to do. And if you do something normal, you're going to make everything normal again. Everything's just going to become normal. And of course, that's not what's going to happen. And when I lead the boys into the bathroom and as I turn on the shower head, I see this figure appear in the doorframe of the bathroom and I look up and it's Annabelle. And she just looked at me and very slowly shook her head. And of course, the boys don't understand. They don't understand what she's telling me. I remember kind of lunging towards her and kind of falling into her arms. And I remember Jake said, what's happening? Why is your face like that? And then I felt Joe just wrap himself around my leg. And I looked down at him and he looked up at me and he said, has Tony died, Ed? And it was the most, it felt so surreal that it should be Joe, the three-year-old, who's actually, of all of us, able to name what's happening. He's the one. And I looked down at him and I said, darling, yes, he has. He's died.
Dicka, when had he died? At what point had he drowned?
You see, this was such a mysterious question for days afterwards. The fisherman said that when they reached him in the water, he was alive. And he said to them, I'm not going to make it. And he said, is Jake okay? Is Jake okay? And they said, yeah, it's okay. And as I'd been standing on the beach pulling what I thought was my perfectly healthy husband back ashore, they say that he just went limp in their arms. And so it was as I was actually pulling him ashore that he had died. They found it difficult to believe. And so for days in the village afterwards, there was this absolute a consensus formed very, very quickly that he must have died of a heart attack. And it's a funny, I understand the impulse why we all wanted to believe that, because that kind of downgrades the tragedy from this horrifying freak accident to, it's still a tragedy, but it was somehow inevitable and maybe, you know, presumably it would have happened anyway. And it seemed to make us all feel better in some bizarre kind of comforting way. But actually when they performed the autopsy, that wasn't the case. He was, what had happened is, although he'd never gone underwater, it was he'd been gasping and flailing in the waves. He'd been inhaling water into his lungs. And so his lungs had filled with water and he'd drowned even while he was on the surface in our friend's arms.
Yeah, I'm really struck when you tell me this story of your own sense of your divided self. Like there's about three or four different parts of you running in different directions there. You sort of, you break in that moment. It's like
you shatter into pieces. It's, you no longer inhabit your own body and you certainly don't feel as if your mind is your own. And it was just chaos. And after, I don't know if it might have been half an hour, it might have been 3 hours, I've no idea. But a friend in the village said, listen, we're going to pack some stuff and we're going to take you to our house. And she lived up, way up in the hills overlooking the ocean. And I remember as we're driving away from the cottage and up into the hills, I have this absolute out-of-body impulse thinking, I'm just going to open the door of her car and I'm running back to that beach because we can't leave him.
Leave him there.
It just felt like the most extraordinary, we're just going to leave him lying there on the beach. But of course, I've got two tiny, terrified children in the back seat. And
were they watching you like hawks?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're so right about this sense of breaking because on the one hand, had our children not been there, I think it would have been an entirely different experience. But as every parent knows this, you know, in these moments of absolute extremis, you have this crushing sense of obligation to be giving them a lead, to be reassuring them. So it's a completely divided sense. What's actually taking place in your head bears no resemblance to the expression that you're trying to assemble on your face and the words that you're trying to form for them.
The bomb that's going off in my head right now, it just will have to be dealt with later.
Absolutely. I think I've become very accustomed to the sense of there being this huge dichotomy between what's going on in my mind and what's coming out of my mouth.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
You were married to another man called Paul when you met Tony. Was it a happy marriage when you met Tony at that time?
Not by the time I met Tony, no. It was blissfully so in the beginning, and you know, had anyone told me that our marriage wasn't going to make it, I would have just been dumbfounded. I had absolute confidence that we would be together forever. You know, I was young and I was in my 20s, and I know a lot of things now that I didn't then. And we both met Tony. We met him because we moved into the street where Tony lived. And for the first year that I knew Tony, he was a friend of both of ours. Our marriage was in terrible, terrible trouble. And I think we'd reached that stage that many couples will recognise where you know you've got to the end, but what happens next is so unimaginable, literally unimaginable, that you're kind of stuck in this rather dead zone where you're waiting to see how you're going to extract yourselves from the marriage. And Tony was in a rather similar situation with his wife, who he'd been with for nearly 20 years. And they had agreed that they were going to separate and she was going to move to Spain. Anyway, we became friends and you really couldn't miss Tony. He was 6'2", staggeringly beautiful, very well built, had a voice like a foghorn. I mean, you really couldn't miss him. He was always out on the street, kind of holding court. And I just took him to be a kind of very happy-go-lucky family man, a kind of very cheerful neighbour. Over the course of the coming year, 18 months that followed, as we became closer friends, I began to have a suspicion that there was rather more to his story than he presented.
Yeah, what was his upbringing?
So he was adopted as a toddler. He doesn't know anything about his birth parents, except that one was white and one was black. And he was adopted by a white family in Yorkshire in the north of England in the 70s, which was a fairly... it was a time when racism and kind of racial prejudice was truly endemic. So Tony had an incredibly difficult childhood. I mean, to illustrate this, it always sounded so implausible to me when he told me this, but he absolutely swore blind that it was true that he burgled his first house when he was 4 years old.
Four?
Four, I know. But actually, I believe him now. He was an absolute compulsive thief. His life was very violent. You know, he was constantly being expelled from schools, getting into trouble. And he fell into that classic cycle where he's always the new kid at school because he's always been expelled from the last school. I mean, I think it's fair to say his formal education was probably over by the time he was 10. And he spent most of the next 5 years incarcerated in one form of kind of borstal or youth detention or another.
How did he get himself sentenced to prison for 14 years?
So when he was 15, he ran away from home to London and became what's known as a hustler in Soho, a drug dealer, basically somebody who's going to rip off whoever they can. And he had a girlfriend who was working as a prostitute, and she worked for a gang of particularly nasty pimps. And Tony persuaded her to sort of flee them. They escaped, and this gang tracked them down to a flat they were living in South London and broke the door down with iron bars and beat the living daylights out of the both of them and dragged her back off to work. And Tony, being very hot-headed and not really knowing any other way to resolve disputes, tracked them down in turn and was convicted whilst he was still in his teens for having shot several of them. There were no fatalities, but, you know, it was serious gun crime. And he was sentenced to 14 years at the Old Bailey, of which he served seven. and was released in his mid-20s and just went straight back to doing exactly what he'd been doing before, only on a much rather larger, more industrial scale.
How did he meet his first wife?
They met, I think, in a nightclub just a couple of weeks after he got out of prison. And she was from California and on a grand tour of Europe and said, come along. And it wouldn't be right of me to say too much about their relationship. But, you know, they had a fairly kind of tempestuous life. Tony always made his money through criminal means. He'd never had a job in his life. There was a fairly high degree of violence involved. And by the time I met him, he'd been for several years then addicted to crack. All of this came out over the course of these very charged late night conversations at my kitchen table. Paul, my husband, was a photographer and had been sent to Afghanistan. And Tony, like all like all good criminals, had a company, a building company that was essentially a money laundering exercise and something to keep up appearances. I didn't realise that at the time when I said, could he maybe get his business to take care of some redecoration of a rental flat that we had. But that kind of became the premise for this contact, and he would drop by each evening to give me an update on the work. And we would sit there and we would sit late into the night, and I would ask him about his life. And he used to literally physically squirm at first, because, of course, one of the absolute cardinal rules of the criminal fraternity is that you do not ask questions under any circumstances.
Yes, but the cardinal rule of a journalist like you are is to ask those penetrating
questions. Absolutely, of course. Mm. So it was slightly odd at first. And he would say, are you interviewing me? I said, no, I'm just nosy. And it would be over the course of these long late night conversations that I got to know the story of his life. I guess it was in the course of those conversations that we fell in love. And so when my husband got back from Afghanistan, I gave myself a thoroughly stern talking to and said, this is ridiculous, Deck. What are you doing? You know, this is really, I know your marriage is basically over, but, you know, this is kind of late night shenanigans, charged kind of conversations with a man who's a crack addict and a criminal and a drug dealer. I mean, this is insane, clearly. And I naively imagined that that would be the end of the matter. And I lasted about 2 days before I remember calling Tony and saying, I need to see you. And we had this kind of ludicrous kind of adolescent assignation around the back of a supermarket in his car when I said I was popping out to get some sour cream. And I recognised then that this was just farcical, that I wasn't going to be able to stop seeing him. But I remember going back with the sour cream from the supermarket thinking, well, whatever happens, Jack, you're leaving home tomorrow. You're done. You know, you cannot be scandaling around behind Paul's back. Our marriage was over, but we never lost respect or affection for each other. And that remains the case to this day. I left my husband the next morning. I went to stay with friends for a couple of days. And then Tony came to see me and he said, I've left too. And he held up this big holdall. I couldn't think even what he meant. He said, well, that's it now. You know, you're my girl. And this is rather unconventional. You know, the first night we ever spent together was in our brand new flat that we had to go and rent. And it was quite surreal. I remember standing next to him in the morning and we were brushing our teeth in front of the mirror. And I'm looking at our reflection thinking, I don't barely know this man. What have I done? You know, my home, my life, my everything, I've walked out on. And here I am in this funny little rental flat with a man who is a criminal and smokes crack and how do I think this is going to end well? You know, and of course I assumed that it would be catastrophic. And it was anthropologically interesting for about 6 months. You know, it was interesting to see how he did his business. We would have this sort of surreal scene where business associates would drop by and I'd make them a cup of tea and we'd make small
talk. Yeah, what did your friends and family make of this? You'd given up this kind of respectable photographer for a crack-smoking crim.
Quite. I think you can imagine, can't you? Right. I mean, the broad consensus was that I had genuinely lost my mind. And I wasn't sure that they were wrong either. You know, that felt like the only really plausible explanation. I would get up in the morning and I would start my day as a journalist. You know, I'd get up at 7 o'clock in the morning like a normal person. Tony would generally get up around 4:30 in the afternoon. First thing he'd somewhere between 4:30 and 6. You know, he'd pop on Sky News, make a coffee, roll a big fat cannabis spliff, and then he'd get on the phone and start growling at people who owed him money. And then he'd go off for kind of various pub car park assignations. And the funny thing is that people generally imagine that drug dealing is a rather glamorous, exciting, kind of high-action lifestyle. Actually, nothing could be further from the truth. Certainly not if you're wholesaling, which was his instance. He wasn't involved in retail. You know, essentially it involves an awful lot of meetings with men in pub car parks.
You must have known, though, I suppose, that any day of the week he could be shot, stabbed, or thrown in prison.
Yeah, it's funny. I look back on that and I think, why did I not worry about that? I mean, one could say I have plenty of other stuff to worry about in the more immediately facing me. I guess the fact that ever since he'd been released from prison, what would that have been, more than 15 years ago, he'd not been arrested for anything. And
so what brought about the change? But then there was something had to change.
Clearly. I mean, this was a very heady, intense, and as I say, rather anthropologically illuminating 6 months. But fundamentally, you know, I'm not a gangster's moll, and that was fairly clear. And also, crucially, you know, I didn't want to live with a drug addict. It was just really boring. You know, he would start smoking crack around midnight and I'd go to bed and he'd carry on till dawn watching crap TV. You know, that's not a life, is it?
No.
So, I mean, don't get me wrong, I was heartbroken. I remember being absolutely brokenhearted because I had fallen in love with him, but I hadn't fallen in love with the life that we could have together. It was plainly untenable. And I wrote a Dear John letter and left it by the bed. And got on a bus and went and sat in a cafe and cried my eyes out. And a few hours later, I mean, obviously many hours later, given the hours that Tony would keep, I received a text message and it just said, I'm gone. And I thought, that's that. You know, that's just the end of a really strange and surreal chapter in my life. And now I need to kind of work out what's normal and real and get back to the real world. Of course, actually, instead, what I did was I ate an enormous amount of chocolate and sort of sat around in my pyjamas swearing and groaning and complaining and hating everybody in the traditional way that one does. And it was, I think, it might have been 3 weeks before we spoke again. And I knew we would, of course. And I sort of thought, I wonder what we'll say to each other and I wonder how it will go. And nothing could have prepared me for the conversation that we had.
What did he say?
He said, Deck, when I got out of bed and I read that note you left, he said, I got dressed. He went and he found the local branch of Narcotics Anonymous. And he went to his first meeting. He said, I've been going to meetings every day. I haven't touched crack and I'm not going to again. And it just, of course, I mean, I was amazed and touched and impressed. I didn't for a minute think that this was a genuine life-changing moment and that he wouldn't go back to it. It's really hard. I can't give up eating chocolate, you know. It felt implausible, but I was, as I say, I was touched and impressed. And in a few days' time, we sort of saw each other. And then, of course, you know, we started meeting up every day. And after a few weeks, given the fact that he was then living with a friend who did smoke crack and he wasn't touching it, I thought, well, this is kind of gratuitous and mad for him to carry on living with a friend who's smoking crack. And of course, I was still in love with him. So I said, why don't you just come and move back in? I'm not naive enough to be unaware of the statistics about relapse and how difficult it is for people to change their life.
It sounds like he was just sick of it, though, himself. Maybe he was
so interesting, isn't it? I think that's exactly right. He just, it's that classic old cliche about addiction, isn't it? That nothing happens until someone profoundly wants to
change. And Narcotics Anonymous and that program allows you to reconstruct your sense of honour around another whole other idea.
That's exactly, because Tony's Tony's identity, Tony would have no sooner gone to see a therapist than gone to see a giraffe, you know, the idea. Whereas what he found in those kind of drafty church halls, you know, where addicts gather, is this extraordinary fraternity of men, hard men like him, who are talking to each other in a way that enabled him to kind of be released from all of that kind of gangster code where you don't talk about your feelings, because it felt gallant and it felt fraternal. And he was absolutely alive with this sense of this sort of new fraternity and it enabled him to talk about his feelings in a way that he hadn't done before. And that, I think, was the very first step of this huge transformation that took place when he suddenly became interested in himself and other people.
So now that he'd given that up, he wanted to go back to school and you helped him with that. How far did he go with that, with his education?
It's funny. I realise, as I'm about to say, it has kind of the quality of a fairy tale.
It does. Yeah,
doesn't it?
Does.
I know. It sounds kind of almost cheesy. He was interested in what was taking place in these meeting rooms, and it made him sign up to do a couple of local evening classes at a local college. And suddenly he thought, God, there's a much more interesting conversation going on somewhere else. From that, he decided to sign up to a 1 year full-time, what's called an access course in the UK, which, if you don't have any conventional school qualifications, you can do this very intensive 1 year course that can then grant you access to university. And I remember him setting off on day one to his class, and he was nervous. You know, he hadn't been at school since he was 10 years old, and he bought industrial quantities of kind of brightly coloured pens to kind of fortify himself. And he set off in high spirits, and I thought, oh God, I hope you've not bitten off more than you can chew. How, what would it even be like for him to sit in a classroom? And he got back at the end of that day. I said, how was it? He went, yeah, it was good. And then he said, Dak, what is a paragraph? And that was day one of the course. And whatever it was, 10 months later, by the time he finished, he graduated top of his class. And the college made him, each year they would choose a kind of stellar student to be their poster boy. And so suddenly his face was on these huge billboards with posters all around where we lived. And he applied to university and he won a gold scholarship to go to Westminster University to study, of course, criminology and psychology.
Bloody hell.
And whilst he was at university, he began working for, it was a kind of youth work charity supporting the most violent, disenfranchised, damaged, kind of drug addicted youngsters in the capital, all of whom, of course, just reminded him of his old self. And he graduated with a first class degree and went to work full time for the charity. And I know that sounds like a fairy tale.
But that's how it was. That's what happened.
That's how it was, yeah.
After 10 years together, you'd been with him, this awful day, this terrible day, and he was gone. And I don't really know how anyone puts their lives back together after that. I don't suppose you ever do you? You never quite get over that, do you?
I think I was wedded to this kind of fallacy that what you're describing is possible. I kind of clung to it. I thought, if I try hard enough, and I think this through enough, there must be a way to put myself back together, to put this family back together. And it's taken me a long time to come to terms with the fact that that's never going to happen.
It's just how it is, isn't it?
It's just how it is, yeah. Yeah, and I've realised now that I think it was a kind of necessary invention at the time. I had to believe that somehow we could be reconstituted. Maybe the reason we all buy into that in the immediate aftermath of a tragedy is because the alternative is literally unbearable. And so you cling to it like a life raft. And I thought that if I just did everything right, somehow I was going to make us okay again. I'd never really understood why they loomed so large, first anniversaries, until I actually experienced it. And they are momentous. And I remember the first anniversary of the day we flew to Jamaica. It's this kind of blithely, naively happy family, and the first anniversary of the day he drowned, and the anniversary of coming home with him in a coffin, and the anniversary of his funeral, and finally the anniversary of his burial. And I remember that day, it was a beautiful, beautiful, it was Midsummer's Day, and then the kids and I went for a picnic by a stream, and I remember thinking, God, I'm laughing at my own naivety now, I remember thinking, we've made it, you know, we're going to be okay. Whatever comes now is going to be better than what we've been through. You know, we've survived. And it was only a matter of weeks, I think 6 weeks after that, that I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and we were at the start of a whole new kind of catastrophe, really. And only this time round, I've promised my kids that nothing terrible's coming. Mm. So the sense of betrayal that I'd worked so hard during that first year to kind of reassure them, because how would they know? They're only 4 and 3. One moment they were on holiday and the next minute their dad's lying on the beach. How do they know that this isn't normal in the universe? And it felt so critically important to restore their confidence and their faith in, that the world will keep turning and that every day terrible things aren't going to happen. I'd invested so much effort in giving them solid ground and assuring them that this is not normal. This is not what normally happens to families. You know, we just got freakishly unlucky. And then I have to sit them down and tell them that actually, no, we're at the start of a whole new chapter of freakishly unlucky ordeal. And it's very difficult at that point to know how to sustain your kids' faith in themselves and their family and their future. And I found myself I found myself kind of almost obsessively kind of repeating, this is just unbelievable bad luck. We've just been incredibly unlucky. But then one day I heard one of the boys say to somebody, it was awful. Think about our families. We're just really unlucky. And it was more than I could bear to hear him say that, because I don't want my kids to grow up feeling kind of cursed. I don't want my kids to grow up feeling like victims.
Well, let me ask you this then. There's a lot of magical thinking that happens around this.
Like,
you blamed yourself, and no one can understand why, and not even you can understand why, but you still did it anyway. Your little boy did too. That's just awful. Poor kid. And it would be perfectly reasonable to feel like you were cursed, or the family, you and your sons, to feel like they were cursed. But was it even more scary to think that you weren't? Like, the world could be that chaotic.
That's such a good question,
yes. The world could be that chaotic and just knock things over without even having any, there's no intent behind that.
That's exactly right. There is the concept of the cursed family. People often say about the Kennedys, don't they? They're cursed. Actually, what it really is it's a psychological device to install some kind of sense of order. Because if you're cursed, then in some obscure way, even if you don't understand it, you kind of deserved what you got. And the world, therefore, continues to be not an arbitrary, capricious, random place, but an orderly, logical, just universe. And the desire to believe in that universe is so great that I think that explains a great deal about, for myself and my son, for why we both blamed ourselves, because I would rather think this was my fault and invent all kinds of bizarre, specious kind of implausible explanations for why it was my fault, because then you've restored order. So I would rather be a bad and culpable person in a universe that has order than be adrift in this kind of random chaos. And I'm sure that's the fundamental motivation for why Jake still to this day sometimes will suddenly announce that it was all his fault. And Jake, for a long time afterwards, said, you know, I'm never going in the ocean again. You know, I hate the ocean, as if the ocean was somehow some kind of active agent in this. And again, it's this thing that we need to in some way impose a logic on it. It's because the ocean's nasty. No, it's not. It's just the ocean.
Did you take him back to that beach?
So I had a very, very powerful instinct that if we didn't go back, then that whole experience would somehow be kind of entombed in dread and mystery, and their memories would fade, and it would have a kind of haunting sense. I felt that very strongly. I also, truthfully, felt if we don't go back for a year, 2 years, 3 years, my children are never going to want to go back, because they're going to have forgotten everything about the place that we loved the most, and it will simply have been reduced to the place where their dad died. And it was such a precious place to us. And I couldn't bear the thought that we're going to lose, you know, we've lost Tony and now we're going to lose the happiest place for us on earth. But of course, I didn't know if it could still be a happy place for us. And when I started talking about going back, everyone thought, people found different formulas of words to express their opinion. But essentially what they were all saying is, are you out of your mind? This is just going to be gratuitously, catastrophically traumatic. This is a kind of experiment in exposure therapy. And if it goes wrong, you are thousands of miles away. Don't be so reckless. And I couldn't know which of us was right. I didn't know if it was a good idea or a bad idea.
Sounds to me like an excellent idea to go there myself.
Oh, really? Yes. Oh, God, I wish I'd consulted you instead of everybody else.
You should have flown out here and I would have said.
That would have been reassuring. Yes. You would have been a lone voice. But we did. We flew back the following February, so 9 months after Tony's death. And the amazing thing is, probably in all of the time since Tony's died, I would say that those 2 weeks are, by far, the happiest, in some ways the only truly, truly happy 2 weeks that we've known. And it was partly about feeling close to him. It was also critically about being back amongst the community of people who were there when it happened.
Could you bawl your eyes out?
What I felt was a tremendous sense of peace, which I hadn't experienced up until that point. No, it wasn't a tearful. Actually, in many ways, it was a kind of almost kind of giddy, heady. You know, sometimes people go wild after a funeral. You know, a wake can take on a kind of bacchanalian quality. In some ways, that family holiday was infused with a similar kind of chemistry. There was a kind of release for all of us. And crucially, Jake had said that he never, ever, ever wanted to go in the ocean again, and that he never would, and that he would never swim. And that troubled me so much, because he'd always been this deeply fearless child, very much like his dad, and I loved that kind of fearless quality. And I think there's something a bit toxic about fear. You start to be afraid of one thing and it starts to bleed, and I just couldn't bear the prospect of seeing this my beautiful, fearless son's kind of become an anxious, neurotic, fearful person. And in the end, on our very first day back there, we went rock pooling on the beach, a different beach. And gradually we just kind of inched further and further into the water, and he turned to me and he said, "Can we swim?" And that was... It's funny, when I think about it now, I realise that it has slightly biblical overtones, doesn't it, about being washed and about being baptised and all of that kind of stuff, of course, which I didn't think about at the time, and I'm not a person of faith, but there it had that kind of cleansing quality about it. And I can't imagine what we'd be like or who we'd be had we not gone back.
Just finally, Dicker, how are you going? How are you doing? I mean, how's your health?
God, who knows? That's the strange thing. I mean, I've completed treatment. I had to have a double mastectomy, and I had to have chemotherapy, and I have to take all kinds of quite unpleasant drugs for the next 10 years. So I would be lying if I said I feel great. You know, I don't feel anything physically like I used to, but I'm working. I'm able to look after my kids. For that, I'm truly grateful.
I wish you nothing but good luck into the future.
Thank you.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Dekker Aitken-Head's book is called All at Sea. abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.